when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day there, Mark Kenny with this week's Democracy Sausage from the ANU. I'm, of course, from the Australian Studies Institute at said institution and the School of Politics and International Relations, where my co-host, Dr. Maria Tafaga, political scientist extraordinaire, is also engaged, employed, overemployed, whatever the term is. Welcome, Maria.
I want to change my business cards to political science extraordinaire.
Yeah.
Please give me new business cards. Hello, everyone.
And it should say overemployed.
I think so. Yeah. Actually, that's
overemployed, underpaid.
I do feel overemployed. And you know what? If you want to take it up with Brian, I'd never say no.
Yes. Well, you know, matters economic are, of course, very sort of prevalent at the moment. We're a week away from the budget as we record this. People would be preparing to go into the lockup a week away from today for the announcement of the financial blueprint for the nation for the next year and for the three out years after that, as they're known. So it's, very much economy all the time in terms of the political discourse at the moment. A little bit of talk about the coronation as well, and we might come to that because we have with us a frequent guest on Democracy Sausage and one of the most valued ones, Professor Frank Bongiorno. How are you, Frank?
I'm well, Mark. How are you? And hi, Maria.
From ANU School of History, I should say, and author of countless excellent books. Welcome, Frank. It's an interesting time in politics, isn't it?
It is, yes. I mean, a few days out from the budget and, maybe the honeymoon starting to reach its kind of conclusion, maybe.
People always say that. This honeymoon has ended a lot of times now and yet sort of continued on as well. So
that's true. It's been a very long honeymoon. Mine was much shorter than that, I have to say. In fact, it was spent in Adelaide apart from other places. But anyway, yeah.
What a great place for a honeymoon. There's a town that's been in a honeymoon for a long time. Now, I shouldn't say that because I'm from Adelaide and I...
That's why you can say that.
That is why I can
actually
say
really that.
But
like
I live in Canberra now, which is sort of a permanent honeymoon, really.
Well, yeah. And I mean, let's face it, like Canberra, Adelaide, they've got a lot in common. Great cities, underrated by the rest of the country.
Yes. In my view. Well, great wine, actually.
Exactly.
This is one of the things. You know, I grew up in wine country in the Adelaide Hills and it's obviously, you know, it's got the reputation for the arts and all of those sort of things. And the wine industry, you know, used to be absolutely, I think it was worth about sort of 75-85% of the wine exports, wine production in Australia for many decades. Other regions have caught up now, and one of those is Canberra, of course, with you know, brands like Clonakilla and others that have become well known. So talk about that.
And they've both got actually really strong traditions of you know, liberal political reform, right? So you know, I think South Australia's colonial history is really underappreciated in this country.
It is, and in fact, so famous have some of the Canberra brands become that there were jokes, I remember, on Twitter as we all went into lockdown in August 2021 about people rushing for the Clonakilla. There was a run on the stuff, you know. Yeah.
So let's talk about the political context of this budget, though, picking up perhaps in some ways your point, Frank, about the extended honeymoon. I mean, it strikes me that honeymoons in politics are in sort of an inherently binary concept in the sense that a government's honeymoon is proportional to the viability, popularity, sustainability, whatever you want to call it, of the alternative government. And the alternative government in this country at the moment is not travelling well. Now, that may go a long way to explaining why the government, you know, is in – I mean, it won with such a low primary vote and relatively low expectations and has exceeded those expectations and by the polls supposedly increased its primary vote quite considerably. And we've seen the primary vote of the coalition going south at the same in the same direction. But that's the context in which we see this, and yet we also see pretty hostile economic circumstances – you know, a cost of living crisis, that's what everyone calls it. And for a lot of people, it genuinely is. It's not technically a recession, but for a lot of people, it genuinely feels like one in terms of their own sort of economic financial viability.
Yeah. And at this stage, people are still clearly not blaming the present government for those problems. I think they're still seeing them as a result of external forces, in some instances a result of the previous government's failure to face up to some of these sorts of issues. Look, honeymoon's a misnomer, I think, for what we're seeing. And as you say, Mark, it is, I think, very shaped by the crisis in the Liberal Party. And it is a crisis. I mean, I think it's pretty clear now that we're not just dealing here with an ordinary post-election, you know, sort of downer, which, you know, I mean, all of us here would remember 2008, you know, that period, difficult period for the Liberal Party, Brendan Nelson, Malcolm Turnbull, you know, hard times and all the rest of it. But I think we're seeing something quite beyond that here. I mean, the Aston by-election, I think, was one indication. The polling that you referred to is another. It doesn't look like an ordinary kind of cyclical downturn of the type that you know, follows elections. It looks more serious. And that clearly is both an enormous benefit to the government, but also a kind of danger too. I mean, it can breed complacency, I think. You might think that you can do things or get away with things or get away with not doing things that in other circumstances you'd be much more careful about. So it'll be interesting to see where we go from here. But yes, I think the weakness of the opposition, again exposed, I think, in recent weeks over the issue of The Voice, where they look, you know, completely at sea at the moment. Mm. Now, maybe that issue will turn out well for them. We just don't know yet. But at present, it doesn't look great for them because they frankly look divided and kind of, perhaps more seriously than divided, rudderless at the moment over that and a number of other issues as well.
Yeah, because I mean, I agree, Frank. Like, I don't think they look divided. They look super concentrated and they're really only talking to the people that are already tuned in to that message. And, you know, I mean, oppositions always sort of have to have that galvanizing phase. But I mean, I think you're right that it is not like 2007-08. Like, at that time, the party had a very clear sense that they were an old government, you know, this is the Howard government, and that they had taken things too far with work choices and frankly disavowing work choices and just sort of allowing, you know, time to take care of things would be sufficient, right? That, you know, I think that was the strong view of the party of the time, and in a way that proved to be prescient because Labor proved it couldn't govern itself in a nutshell, to simplify.
And Tony Abbott did eventually declare work choices dead, buried and cremated in that order, which was always...
And a lot of other promises that he then overturned.
But true, but it's interesting that he eventually came to the view that needed to be said in that theatrical way, really to sort of drive home the point that they weren't going back there.
And remember, he was like one of the two cabinet members that was against work choices. So it was a really, I think, from someone like Tony Abbott, a really credible declaration. And I think you're right about the sort of the honeymoon being like, we should really unpack that term. Like, I actually think what's kind of gone on here is that the government has essentially sort of acted like your parents, right? Who are like, yep, we've got a flood in the house. There's, you know, we've got dangerous power situation here. Like, you know, there are several problems here. Kids, don't touch anything whilst we try to like fix the worst problem and then move on to the next one. Because, you know, the government has actually ground out some important stopgap policies. I think about the, you know, I mean, the government was telling us to turn off our heaters, you know, what, like eight, nine months ago because of the problem with the energy sector. You know, last week a lot of their reviews have come to bear fruit. And whilst the government is definitely being criticised for not going really strongly and really hard in this first term, they are actually, I think, methodically setting up the groundwork for a long run of reforms that would happen slowly over time and that would be bedded down. And I think that's something that's actually kind of important and something that we were sort of talking a bit about last week, Mark. We were talking about the nature of promises and whether or not, you know, there's this idea that's built up in Australian politics, which I think comes from US politics because of the way their term limit systems work, that if you don't do anything in the and the way their Congress and Senate works,
or
if you don't,
work,
yeah. That's right, exactly, it doesn't work, that if you don't do things in the first 100 days, that they're never going to happen. And I think if you actually look at successful governments in Australian history, that's not what they do. They build up ideas for reform over time and they build coalitions and those reforms stay bedded down. Governments that don't do that see their reforms repealed. Whitlam being a good one, Gillard.
Yeah.
Tax
governments have to live while they're being governments. You know, they have to actually exist, understand the world they're living in, adjust to it, identify priorities, work out programs for the delivery of those things and the modification of things, and deal with the unknowns that inevitably all governments are buttressed by. Just want to go back to your point about a galvanizing period, I think was the term you used, for oppositions. It is certainly true that that is what the opposition is in at the moment. I mean, if we think about Peter Dutton's logic that we can discern from the nature of the messaging he's done, and indeed from the messaging that has been entirely absent from, that we might have expected. And that is that there's only one group of voters that can remove him at the moment. Opposition leaders are very vulnerable. They, you know, history shows that, and particularly those that take over immediately after losing government. There's only one group of voters who can take that job off him, and that is the members of parliament in his party room, particularly in the Liberal Party room. And that's who he's speaking to at the moment. And he's sort of almost turning it into a kind of a cult-like situation where it's all about belief in the so-called values of the Liberal Party. And in his case, that interpretation of them is a very conservative reading of the Liberal Party, quite different, Frank, from the view of Robert Menzies when he set up the party, for example. I mean, quite explicitly different. It's a much more conservative view. And we saw, and we've spoken about this before, but we saw Dutton not make any sort of acknowledgement of the voters in his first press conference when he took over as opposition leader. He didn't say, we heard the message, we've learnt, we understand the community's at a different place on climate change, at a different place on corruption, at a different place on women. These are the issues that a lot of Liberal voters wanted to see faster change on, and we're going to go away now and sort of work on how we address those. He didn't say any of that. He said, we're not going after those teal seats that we lost in that process. We're going to be going after the suburban seats rather than the urban seats, and we're going to rebuild ourselves in the regions and the urban areas of the cities. And that message was again sort of reinforced after the Aston by-election, which was one of those very suburban seats he was talking about rebuilding the Liberal Party in. And yet still there is no sort of change of direction from him. And we note, really, going back to the point about galvanization, Maria's point, if we think about, you mentioned Brendan Nelson before, you know, if we think about when Brendan Nelson took over and you know, there was Abbott and Turnbull, both options for the leadership at that time.
And Costello initially too.
That's right. Yeah. He was still there. He was running his memoirs.
He was, although he'd made it pretty clear that he didn't want that he wasn't going to do it. But yeah, there were a range of options that is quite different from now, right? We know that Nelson didn't last very long, and then he was replaced by Turnbull, and then Turnbull was replaced by Abbott, and, you know, and on the cycle kind of went. This has been much more stable, but to use Maria's term as well, much more concentrated in a perhaps not a really good way.
Yeah, and I think when he started talking about the appeal to regional voters after, as it was after the Aston by-election, I think it, you know, that was the moment where the emperor had no clothes, because they'll never win an election that way. And it also just signalled how far they were from the broad church of either Menzies or Howard in talking in that kind of way. Look, the approach he's taken can probably work early in a term of an opposition leader, but the pressure will come on, won't it? As you get into the second year and as you get closer to the next election, people are going to start worrying about their seats.
Yeah, that's true. Can we actually win? Can we actually even survive?
Yeah. Can we win? Or you know, what about my seat? That sort of appeal too, which you know, is going to have its effects in places.
It does
like
focus the mind of the average backbencher. Yeah,
it does. So, you know, you can kind of get away with it at the moment. It's a gamble, I think, isn't it? Isn't he gambling on something like the kind of Rudd scenario where this Labor government proves itself unable to govern adequately, or the cost of living crisis gets the better of it, or somehow Ruvery is able to manoeuvre so that the voice creates some sort of crisis of leadership of the Labor Party, you know, if it were to be defeated or something along those lines? It looks like a kind of roll of the dice. And to be fair, he doesn't have too many options because, you know, the key problem they have is not the government's majority is very small, but there's this huge buffer now. There's this huge.
But it got bigger. That's never happened. It actually got bigger.
Yeah. Well, it did get bigger in the Aston by-election, but there's also this huge crossbench, this huge and complex crossbench that now sits between the coalition and any prospect of returning to government. Mm. Now, you know, it may be that down the track you could imagine some sort of arrangement between the Liberal Party and part of that crossbench to govern as a minority, some of the independents perhaps. But the Greens are never going to jump that way, and they're already, what, four seats now? Mm. Yeah, they're as good as Labor seats, really, from the perspective of Dutton and the coalition. So it seems to me that the narrowness of Labor's victory, the smallness of that primary vote, all of that seems a bit beside the point when you judge where the coalition and where Dutton sit at the moment. They just seem to me to sit a very long way from returning to government for basic mathematical reasons apart from anything else.
Well, do you think, really, that they could, you know, going to Frank's point about how the views of backbenchers or the members of the party might change as they go forward, I mean, that they'll eventually sort of twig to this reality that Dutton's position is made safer by the process that he's gone through, but their electoral position is made more vulnerable.
That might be true for the handful of moderates that remain. But if you think about that LNP locus of the party now, you know, they're not Labor seats. They're not going to Labor. They're not going to the Greens. Their primary vote is so low. It was around 34%, which is the Liberal Party to govern typically needs a primary vote over 40. Okay, so a primary vote around 34, 35% is catastrophically low for that party. Labor got 32%. I think this is actually really important for us to kind of understand that the way the electoral map is actually really shifting. And it's, I mean, I, you know, I don't pretend to know what's in Peter Dutton's head, but I'm starting to think that questions like The Voice, for example, are a bit like gay marriage might have been for Tony Abbott and Scott Morrison, where they were surprised when the electorate returned a yes vote, you know, that they thought
quite decisively.
Exactly, that they thought they were onto a winner here. And perhaps that is what the prevailing view in the party room is, because it might just be literally a selection effect of who MPs are talking to.
Yeah, this is, you know, they used to talk about the Canberra bubble, but politicians are subject to this sort of bubble themselves, and political parties, they talk to their own like-minded constituents, their branch members, their colleagues. They reinforce each other's views on a fairly, you know, constant basis. And it appears like that, you know, we've seen it happen, that you get this kind of just gradual separation from community sentiment, and same-sex marriage was a really good example of that, and I think it's showing up now with The Voice as well.
And I actually think it's really revealing that they have chosen to really focus on these culture war issues rather than the cost of living crisis, which is, you know, bread and butter politics. They could really do damage to the government on that. You know, the government's so vulnerable there. It's like in many ways, it's really not the government's fault, but when in the past has that ever mattered?
Never.
Right? Yeah. So I think that's good for the government because it gives a bit of time to breathe and to think strategically, which is the only way we're going to get out of this mess. Right? If the government just sort of does short-term announcements, we're just going to have the same crap we've had since, the mid-2000s. So we are at a really kind of interesting time, and I'd be happy to see the coalition just drop this fiction of the broad church, because I don't think that's been true for a very – it's never really been true. I mean, I think this is a sort of funny discourse we have around the coalition, right, which is actually an odd marriage, if you think about it. Like, before the Labor Party came on, the government and the opposition were the Conservatives versus the Liberals. They were the unresolvable political opposites in our polity. And Labor came along, worked out party discipline, and really scrambled the whole system. And the two more right-wing parties worked out that they had to combine to block Labor. And they have never really been happily married, right? And there's always this debate in the media saying like, oh, the Liberals have to like resolve their ideological differences. They never resolve them. They are actually zero sum on a lot of dimensions. One part of the party dominates the other. For a long time, the Liberal bit dominated the Conservative bit. Now the Conservative bit dominates the Liberal bit.
And the one place it didn't, Frank, dominate, the one place where it was reversed was Queensland. And we now see, in a sense, ironically, the kind of LNPisation of the Liberal Party. We see this kind of LNP sensibility that seems to have taken hold. And the reflex is to socially conservative views every time. Quite prejudicially. I mean, there's no gainsaying the fact that the Nats in November of last year chose to oppose The Voice before any of the wording was out, before anything like the review that's only just completed in Parliament now has done its work, you know, the committee stage and so forth. Mm. They just declared their position. And in a sense, they declared the Liberal Party's position as well.
They did. And it's a reminder of how resilient the National Party has been as a mm-hmm. as a political and electoral force.
And self-interested as well.
Very self-interested, but also the great survivor. I mean, you know, I remember living in New England, in northern New South Wales in the early 2000s, and you sort of looked at the scenario up there and you think, how is the National Party even going to survive? I mean, all our local seats, federal and state, were represented by independents.
There was quite a strong discourse of that around that time. Yeah.
And then the 2011 state election came around and it was absolutely resurgent. They won a great pile of seats. They won back seats from independents. They demonstrated that they had remained a strong presence in civil society in a lot of regional mm-hmm. and rural areas in ways that, in fact, frankly, the Liberals and Labor have failed to do on the ground. And we're seeing some of the consequences of that resilience. I mean, it was one of the things that destroyed Malcolm Turnbull's prime ministership, surely. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, you know, his own Liberal Party right wing. It was also the coalition agreement and the constraints on him. And we don't know what was in the coalition agreement.
Because Barnaby Joyce said that the first, second, third, fourth, fifth and sixth priorities was that it remained secret. And he said that publicly and proudly, which was extraordinary to me. Because
it was also the first time they codified that agreement. Before, it used to be a handshake.
Well, yeah, but we don't know. We should be able to know what's in the agreement, particularly when they're in government, because it effectively traded policy positions for ministerial spots. I mean, let's be clear about this. That's a matter of public interest to know whether the Prime Minister, for example, even had scope to do something like the National Energy Guarantee or same-sex marriage or move in any way on the climate change question. Did he have scope to do that, or was it in fact an explicit commitment seated in the coalition agreement? I mean, I was astounded that, and I still am astounded, frankly, that in our polity, in which we think transparency is an absolute, you know, a virtue that should always be protected and pursued, that there wasn't much more made of that.
Well, that government, if we remind ourselves, did have a bit of a difficult relationship with the concept of transparency. That was a theme of the last government.
It was, but it's also another way in which, you know, Australia's political parties don't conform to decent democratic norms.
Yeah, that's true.
Or the norms expected of other organisations.
Well, that's what I mean, really, by decent. Yeah. That's kind of what I mean by decent. I mean, we see it.
And that even
branch stacking and all the rest of it. But there's another example.
Yeah, you know? And it goes to things like the treatment of information about electors, for example, and their membership base and their donations and a whole range of ways in which they, as you say, exemptions. Let's take a very quick break and be back in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. You're with Democracy Sausage from ANU. Now, Maria, you wanted to pull up a point that Frank just made?
Yeah. So Frank made a really good point about the National Party, right? And it relates to something that Labor is interested in doing. And I think it's good to remind people, you know, like unlike the Greens, for example, who actually got, I think, 400,000 roughly more votes than the National Party at the last election. I think the Greens got about 1.2 million votes and the Nats got about 800,000,
right.
Give or take. It's been a while since I've looked at the figures. But it goes to show that the National Party's votes are super concentrated and they're able to translate that into political representation, right?
Yeah, to geographic representation.
Exactly. And Labor is currently investigating whether or not to expand the number of seats in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, this is quite fascinating.
Yeah, which because it goes to that long-held principle that Labor has, which I'm sure Frank can talk to, about one vote, one value, this being a real sort of issue in our political system. And Hawke did this in 1884, right? And it will definitely, if they go through with this, it will definitely change the map. And I can imagine it would also boost the number of Greens seats, right? It just theoretically that should happen because their vote is concentrated as well. It's just that it's not concentrated in quite the same convenient kind of way. But Frank, do you remember much about how that debate evolved in like 83, 84? I've just put you on the spot.
I don't remember it much as a debate. And of
yeah,
course,
I don't either.
Yeah. And Labor did very poorly at the 1984 election. I mean, they lost seats in expanded parliament.
A 10-week campaign will do that to you.
So, yeah, I don't remember it as much of a debate. But clearly, you know, the National Party have been under occasional pressure in redistributions when particularly seats in very isolated, well, you know, sort of, I guess, western parts of New South Wales. So one disappeared, didn't it, in the early 2000s, which I can't remember the exact details now, but and there's usually a bit of hullabaloo around that. The one vote, one value debate was much more prominent, of course, during the Whitlam period and was one of the issues on which the double dissolution election and then the 1974 joint sitting deliberated. It reduced the variation that was allowable, I think, from 20% to 10%, and you know, it was the country party of the
that
day.
Is, sorry, just to explain, that's the variation in numbers of electors in a given electorate,
and if you let
that variation get too big, you're into gerrymandering territory, and gerrymanders were quite prominent in Australian electoral history, particularly in the states and particularly in upper houses and so forth right around the country.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, notoriously in South Australia.
Yeah.
But in a number of
places.
And
in fact, Steele Hall voted to end it and effectively ended his premiership in the process.
He did indeed, yeah. So, I mean, that was a big issue in the Whitlam period, and Doug Anthony and the country, what were they called by then? The National Country Party.
Yeah.
Anyway, were very much. I mean, that's where the key opposition to the Whitlam proposal was coming from.
Yes, it's a fascinating sort of area. This question about where the Nats are and where the Libs are, because you know you really do have that sense. I think now that the Nats just hold their position and the Libs sort of quake around a bit and eventually fall into line. And we saw that happen on a number of things. And Dutton's clearly made the decision at the moment. As I say, he figures that the only people that can remove him are his colleagues, and so he's keeping them happy. And it'll be interesting to see, Maria, whether that changes, as you say, as they get closer to the election and they think, oh, hang on, you know, my voters. And how much do you think, get both your views on this, how much do you think the voice, the decision they've taken on the voice, because that idea about a broad church, which, you know, Howard used to talk about a lot, you don't hear it so much now, but as you say, it still comes up. That broad church thing seems completely inconsistent with the idea of binding your party room on this question of the voice. If you acknowledge that there's a wide congregation with diverse views and then you say, but here's the line, you know.
I don't really understand why he went down that path. it's not entirely clear to me why he made the decision to bind cabinets.
No. Is it just sort of the Abbott reflex of maximum opposition all the time?
I imagine, I'm thinking as a party leader, it might on a question like The Voice, where we're really only one step away from talking about whether or not people are is opposition is racist, right? You know, like that is a subtext of this conversation that we are pasting over with conversations around the constitutional implications. And I think having a bunch of powerful and articulate advocates from within his own cabinet advocating for The Voice only invites journalists to push him on the logic and the rationale, which is already struggling to bear weight because their positions are actually really very close in the actual brass tacks of the differences between a Canberra voice and these regional voices, right? Like they're just nested. And I just think that would become quite difficult a position for him to maintain, particularly when even conservative constitutional advocates like Greg Craven have sort of looked at the advice from the
Solicitor General.
Thank you, that's the name. It's the Solicitor General, and you know, many of their concerns have been reduced. Like
the ground's just cut out from under them on a whole range of things. You don't really hear anyone running the third chamber of Parliament canard anymore either, because it was just silly and
thank God for that, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is the thing, right, with the coalition.
Canberra like, voice, I mean, what a lot of nonsense.
Well, they've got a big problem around that because their formal policy is for a legislated Canberra voice.
Yeah.
And that's not going to go away.
Yeah.
That's not going to go away. Also, that's going to come back to haunt them in the months ahead.
It will. Yeah. And also there's the problem they have where if they have regional voices, you can't just have no mechanism whereby those regional voices actually consult with government or consult with the parliament.
I mean, you know, it opens up a whole can of worms, right? Like, you know, are they supposed to be talking to the state governments then? Well, how do you get the state governments to listen to them, right? Well,
like, and the state governments, like South Australia now, has its own voice. Yeah.
Precisely. And, I mean, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of the government for failing to provide the detail, but I think this is actually a red herring. Like, I mean, ultimately, this question is a question of principle, and that's what the Constitution is ultimately about. It isn't actually a very prescriptive set of rules, and the political science literature actually shows that, you know, like it's quite a crude measure, but the longer your constitution is, the worse the outcomes ultimately, because there's no flexibility in them, right? And the question itself ultimately resolves most of these issues, because it's very clear that we must have a voice, but that Parliament dictates what that voice looks like. And to be blunt, there's nothing precluding a future government from saying the voice is one person that I appoint, which would be a real violation of the spirit of the voice. But in effect, the Parliament has the ability to shape all of those domains.
That points the fact that, you know, inevitably the way it's shaped will be a political process.
Exactly.
And it will evolve. I mean, the best parallel I can think of is the High Court itself.
The High Court itself,
I mean, go
indeed
to the Constitution, have a look and see if the present High Court is in any way described. It's not. I mean, you get the basic framework, but there was nothing on how many justices.
Nah.
Would it be a circuit court, or would it sit in the capital, or would it, you know? I mean, there was none of this.
And Toomey makes the point that you do not freeze complex matters in the Constitution. That is anti-democratic. What you put in the Constitution is heads of power for the Parliament to create and to design and so forth, which is what we're doing here, and it's entirely consistent with the way the Constitution was set up and with good practice in a democracy.
And I think what's really kind of interesting, right, like we are clearly seeing a trend of de-alignment in Australian politics, coming off a really high base. Like, you know, comparatively, Australia has historically had really high levels of what we call party identification. That is, you vote for party A on your 18th birthday, and you're 97 in your last election voting, you're voting for party A, okay? 80% of people used to do that. And that has been a trend that's only started to break down in the last 10 to 15 years, and we're now at more than a third of people doing this, and there's no real reason, there's no kind of counter-cyclical thing to kind of point as to why this trend would reverse. It may stabilize, right, at this level, but I don't see why we should necessarily reverse in a major way. And so that actually means, and I kind of mentioned, right, what the primary vote for the Coalition and the Labor Party was. It's collectively just under 70%. But that actually means that there is the possibility of building a coalition for the voice out there that isn't dependent on having the opposition on board. Like, that's actually a live possibility now that was not the case at the time of the Republican referendum.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's actually a really interesting time in politics. And so the sort of historical precedent that a lot of people are relying on as a heuristic, that data is potentially really unstable, and it may be actually a really bad bet for the coalition to think that the vote will go down. Like, it's probably going to be quite narrow.
Well, this has been the calculation, I think, that the government has made and that the Yes campaign has made, that we're not prisoner to that history. We're not hostage to those circumstances forever forward. And it is quite clear. We saw it with the same-sex marriage survey. There were a lot of vagaries around it, and, of course, it's a different issue. But we saw that the electorate had a sort of an, you know, I described it at the time as a kind of an unfussy support for that change. It just wasn't something about which ordinary people, for the most part, were particularly animated. They, well, yeah, of course, why not? That's fair. Let's just do that. And you had all these churchy politicians, you know, getting very hot under the collar about it and talking about it as if the entire future of the country and society and Western civilization and everything else hung on it. And, of course, the people didn't decide that. And you get a feeling that we might be seeing some of that same dynamic. Yeah. And what are we? Only 31, 32 days since we saw history just completely trammelled in the Aston by-election anyway.
Yeah, the best hope for it is that enough people, as with the same-sex marriage, judge, oh, it's not going to affect me, whatever. Yes, I'll,
Well, or it so is that, going to affect me. And I think that, maybe I'm sorry to cut you off there, but yeah. I like to think that there'll be a lot of people who think it's not going to affect me negatively. And it seems fair.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of where I think a lot of people, particularly more conservative people, landed with same-sex marriage. So if somehow the Yes case can craft or shape a debate around that kind of idea, I think that would be incredibly beneficial for the Yes case. I mean, the danger in these with a proposal like this is always the argument about special treatment.
Exactly.
We've seen Abbott and others trot out just in recent days, why do you give special arrangements for 4% of the population or whatever? If that argument takes hold, there's going to be trouble, I think, for the Yes case. But if you can counter that argument by saying that it's not going to, this change will not affect most people and it's a fair thing for those who it will affect, I think you're in much stronger ground to get a Yes case up. But you've got to do it in four states, remember, and that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, it's a high hurdle here. I mean, I don't see too many people questioning the idea that a majority of votes across the nation is out of reach at all. That's probably on the basis of what we understand going to happen. The question then is, where do those, where do you find your 4 out of 6 states? And this, is one of the other problems with the constitution that's currently written, is that the ACT and the Northern Territory, being the location of the highest concentrations of Indigenous people, and the ACT, of course, being a progressive jurisdiction, not that far short now in population of Tasmania, and does not count as a state. And so ACT will vote yes. Victoria will probably vote yes. Good chance South Australia will vote, Northern Territory will vote yes. New South Wales will vote yes. I mean, if you get New South Wales and Victoria voting yes, you're getting pretty close to your population 50% anyway, because of this load of population there. So it's then a question of, well, do you get South Australia? Do you get Tasmania perhaps, where the Liberal government there is very, very supportive of it? There's a strong discourse there. I'm more optimistic at this stage of the Yes case getting up than I have been pretty much at any point so far. And in reality, the Yes case hasn't even kicked off yet. So there's a bit to go.
Yeah, no, I think I'd agree. I'm certainly more optimistic than I was in January coming out of the summer. The worst case around that issue, the kind of double majority issue, is a repeat of 1977, where you had a proposal, I think, for simultaneous elections, 62% yes vote, and it went down.
Yeah.
It was 3-3. Because, yes, I mean, New South Wales voted yes, Victoria voted yes. I can't remember who the other one was, but basically it went down because of it didn't get to 4-2. So it can happen,
It's
became more likely, of course, once the territories got votes, because they didn't even get votes, remember, until in referendum things.
The territory votes count towards the national.
They do now.
The national amount, you know, the national proportion, but they don't count as jurisdictions in. I mean, that's just something that should change but probably won't. I mean, it's really fascinating to think about this in terms of the dynamic, the political dynamics for this. We were talking before about, you know, the calculation Dutton's making, and, you know, you said, Frank, perhaps he's hoping for events to turn his way. It's actually quite hard to forecast even what the dynamics would be out of the two scenarios of the yes case getting up or not getting up. Does that, I mean, for example, if a majority of Australians vote for the Voice, but it doesn't get that state hurdle, doesn't clear that state hurdle, how do people view Dutton in that circumstance? He has vandalised, in a sense, this attempt, but he hasn't convinced a majority of Australians in the process. Does that actually really serve his interests? I mean, I'm pretty sure he'd take it. He'd take it as a win. He'd think that he'd take some skin off Albanese in that regard.
Yeah.
There'd be some blame attaching to the government in terms of the way it's gone about it. Very hard to read what the longer term implications for either side would be. I know that's a secondary issue, frankly, behind the substance of the referendum itself.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I've thought about that one. I honestly don't know. I don't know which way the debate would go afterwards. I mean, there is a view that says if the Voice doesn't succeed, it mightn't have any terribly negative political effects on the government, that they may
I've heard
be more
too.
Negative for the opposition. I honestly don't know. It'd be just guesswork on my part.
Yeah.
Where does one look for precedence? There isn't one.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And I think there is more flexibility, like just from a political scenario, to consider the political ramifications for the government. I mean, the government is taking a stand on principle and taking a risk, which is more than any government has done on this issue for 15 years when it really kind of came onto the agenda. You know, and I think that's actually kind of important.
It is. It's worth acknowledging that because the new PM, on the very moment he took over, stood up at the lectern on election night, made this his year one priority, and his first term priority at least, and certainly leaned into it in year one. We're still in year one, I should note, of the Prime Minister's first term.
Mm.
So, you know, that has taken a degree of courage, and it does come with some risks. But if it gets up, as we've been saying, you know, we think it will, that's a pretty significant achievement for any government, really, and particularly Labor's. You know, we often hear about, you know, eight out of 44 referendum questions have succeeded. Only one of those eight was put forward by a Labor government. Labor's only ever successfully changed the constitution once.
And three of them were on one day in 1977. Yeah. Three yes votes on one day in 1977.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Mm. I mean, I think this kind of sort of circles back to the point we were talking about right at the beginning, you know, Labor's quote-unquote honeymoon. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of Labor. Some of it, I think, just unfair. Like if you are a natural Greens voter and you're slagging off the government, that's fine. But, like, they're not really – the ALP government isn't trying to measure itself by a Greens voter standard. That's, you know, that's because those two parties actually don't get along and don't like each other for good reason.
They're both right.
Yeah, that's a – well, sure, you know, exactly.
Well, they compete for the same constituency.
Precisely. Yeah. And one is a party of government and one isn't, and that just ultimately shapes the frame of view in which they view the world and the realities of having to govern. But Labor is taking risks and is trying to actually solve problems, and that means making trade-offs.
Yeah,
well, and I think that is actually being recognised in enough parts of the electorate that this honeymoon is is being extended. And it's actually really great to see an internal debate within Labor over, for example, lifting the job seeker rate. It reminds me of when the left would pop up and complain in the 80s during the Hawke government, you know, pushing that government to think through its policy choices in a more rigorous way.
It's an interesting comparison, though, because I think it's true to say, as a generalization, that the policy process was more transparent then than it is now, and that there was a little more kind of what you might call mess or friction within the Labor government, and which made it into the public realm, and which actually in the end, I think, added to the quality of decision making in the process. So I think you can take internal unity and discipline and message management and so forth, you can take it too far, and I think basically this is an ill of contemporary politics, not just this government, but generally this sort of tendency to be sort of almost pathologically disciplined and to stifle creativity and keep things too tidy.
Yeah, and I think certainly around domestic policy, this government's been pretty good actually in being willing to allow debates to run. I mean, the Voice is a good example actually. Providing some space for dissent within the party, allowing reports to get out there from the various inquiries that it's commissioned that are actually front running, that are well ahead of what the government's prepared to do. We saw that with Job Seeker. Mm-hmm. The one issue where it has shown no inclination whatsoever to encourage debate is on AUKUS, and that's why Keating's intervention was so critical, because he is, you know, the party's elder statesman going to the National Press Club and giving him hell, and it opened up the debate finally, and it exposed the fact that they're not willing to have a debate around the issues centred on AUKUS.
In a way, though, I think they would have been glad that he over-egged it, because it gave them some capacity to kind of demonise that side, because you know Keating's rather percussive approach, maybe concussive might even be better. You know, somewhat. You know, he would struggle to have people sort of stand up, stand next to him. You know, when he was sort of dismantling Wong's credibility and describing her work as consular work, for example.
Yeah, there was that dreadful line about wearing lays around her neck in the Pacific or something.
That's not foreign policy. Yeah.
And he went too far. There's no doubt about that. But he also has credibility. He has immense credibility within public culture, and especially within the Labor Party and Labor movement. And that is, you know, that is the space, if you like, where there is a real reluctance to encourage debate. And of course, the main way in which Labor has discouraged debate is by refusing to articulate, you know, the strategic goals behind AUKUS. You know, what's it all about? Mm-hmm. What is really the thinking behind it? And in failing to do that, they make it hard and slippery for others to actually come in and actually engage in any contestation.
Their review has declared some more reviews.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll find out.
That's right.
I mean, to be fair, I think on a whole range of issues that they have allowed debate to happen, and that has been incredibly liberating, I think, for the public culture.
Yeah, yeah. So from Labor royalty just quickly to actual arcane royalty. What's happening? The coronation is happening. I had to really think about that. You can tell I'm heavily engaged in this. And ministers are being asked, as Jim Chalmers was this morning, as we record this, was asked whether he'd be standing and swearing allegiance to the king. The prime minister's obviously going to the coronation. Every state governor and the governor general are going, so that a former governor general has to sort of step in. He's been tagged and has to step in. What sort of bizarre business is this?
Well, I heard that we'll all be invited to swear allegiance through our TVs to the new King Charles.
I thought my TV was watching me.
if it's an Amazon TV, it almost certainly is.
Yeah.
No, it's a Huawei, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, right. Well, yeah. Well, nothing wrong there.
Someone's watching it.
Exactly. But, so as I understand it, in the coronation ceremony, the peers swear allegiance to the king. That makes a lot of sense to me. You know, that's sort of like a reinforcing of their sort of own status. But I just sort of thought, like, oh, well, this is like an interesting thought from the palace, like to democratize this process. And my favorite bit in the statement was where they would invite everyone from the Commonwealth and the empire, like, or the ex-empire more broadly. It's like, do you guys not kind of get like where this discourse is at right now? I just thought that was very...
Well, maybe they do.
Maybe.
I mean, we've still got their flag and our flag. Well, and we've been given the nudge several times, but we're still living it, you know.
I don't know. I just thought this was... It makes sense, I suppose, in London and in Buckingham Palace, but I just think it's odd.
I mean, I don't know what Jim Chalmers said in reply, but surely...
He said that he's already sworn an oath in Parliament that he doesn't... something along
those lines. Lucky him.
He did well.
I mean, the point is kind of, if he'd said, no, I'm not going to, that's ridiculous, it wouldn't have lost him a single vote. And that's the point, isn't it, about the monarchy in Australia today? I mean... The monarchy is not a presence in Australian public culture. I mean, here we are sitting.
The ABC wore black ties for 2 weeks.
And it was contrived, and people thought it was really, really weird. And
it went back to being a BBC derivative for a couple of weeks.
And it looked and sounded ridiculous. And they they really did look silly, sending so many people to London for the funeral, all the rest of it. And
at least we've learned from that. We're not sending too many people to the coronation, except every state government and the governor.
they are the monarch's representatives. That's like, if they weren't going, I think we'd scratch our heads.
The states are the monarch's representatives.
Well, they're sovereign states,
In a sense, it sort of underlines, doesn't it, the dysfunctionality of this system now for us, because, I mean, the whole purpose of it is that it is meant to kind of just allow things to run smoothly and all the rest of it. In fact, but you know, we have a coronation and we have to bring in, as you say, a former Governor General to do a job that should at the very least have been covered by one of the state governors staying home. I mean, a radical concept.
Yeah.
Imagine if one of them had stayed home, you know, and to do their job, the job that they're paid large sums of money to do. Yeah. That would have been extraordinary.
Now, look, we've gone way over time here, and I'm going to risk going even further over time because I just want to read you this letter. And I do this by way of encouraging listeners to send us letters and on email, that is, democracysausage@anu.edu.au. And this one is from Andrew Rothberg. He says, "Hi, Mark and Maria. Love the podcast. It's become a staple I listen to weekly." I like that. As you gave your email address at the end of the Trent Zimmern episode, I thought I'd share the nagging thought I had throughout. Trent said the Liberal Party is the party of buying houses and aspiration. That may have been true for their traditional base, boomers, but it isn't the case now. Their policies, and he lists negative gearing and capital gains tax in particular, has made it harder for Gen X and Z to buy a house, myself included, and this has really put a wet blanket on aspiration. I recently heard Senator James Patterson talk of similar values, which strikes me as odd given it's demonstrably true that their policies have made buying a home more difficult. More of a vent than a question, but he wanted to get it off his chest. I thought I'd just put that to you, Maria, because it's an interesting point, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's the party of aspiration, but the aspiration to own a home, as we discussed with Trent and others, has become just that, an aspiration.
Well, yes, and there's a good point there, and I guess I would just remind people there was that brief window where I believe Scott Morrison as treasurer was interested in tackling the negative gearing tax concessions. And I guess the most generous interpretation of this is that there are parts of the Liberal Party that have recognised that they are killing the golden goose that lays the golden eggs by locking young people out of the very thing that allows them to accumulate wealth and
vote Liberal.
And vote Liberal. Menzies, if we go right back to Menzies understood the value of
home ownership. It's the great achievement of really the Menzies era. I mean, home ownership went from 50% of owner-occupiers to 71% in the space of 15 years.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the great transformations, really, in Australian history in such a short period of time. And it coincides almost precisely with that era of coalition rule under Menzies.
And Menzies, you know, through that period, also perfected the political side of it as well as getting that economic side of it. He then perfected the political side of talking to those households, of talking to the people who are running those households, of
the sort women of
politically enfranchising women in into the debate. I mean, not necessarily in what you'd call a feminist way, but certainly in a way that brought them into the conversation. Yeah. And that was politically extremely effective.
Yep, absolutely. And it was a pragmatic conservatism that required a strong hand in dealing with banks over issues like lending. You know, that they could do a lot worse than actually look at that kind of pragmatic conservatism of Menzies and revive some aspects of it.
And I would pair thought. Economic policy with a conversation with the electors you need to get. Now, you don't do that if the electors you need to get don't hold the same view as you on questions like the participation of women in the economy, on matters like climate change, corruption, the voice, these sorts of things. And that's, you know, goes back to what we were saying before. So there's a real job of work there for the conservative side of politics to think about how it rebuilds a political constituency. If we look at those recent polls we were talking about earlier, and we were talking about primary votes, if you take out the Nationals vote from the primary vote of the coalition at the moment, according to Resolve and a few others, it's in the 20s. Mm. The Liberal Party's primary vote is in the 20s at the moment. Now, we're between elections and all that, all those caveats, but nonetheless, they're in a world of pain, and perhaps they're also a bit deluded about how deep that trench is. We'll see. Hey, look, it's been a really great conversation, a lot of fun, as usual. We never really got to talk much in detail about the budget, but what the hell? I mean, everyone
budget
else is talking.
Yeah,
exactly. Let's talk about it when we actually know what's in it.
Yeah, uselessly speculating.
Yeah, that's right. So thanks, Maria, and thanks, Frank. Really
thanks,
great to talk.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you.
That's Democracy Sausage for this week. If you like the podcast, don't forget to subscribe if you can, and then you can give us a rating. And until next week, in fact, it'll be a bit late next week because we will wait till after the budget, which means sort of we'll probably have a chat on about Wednesday morning and you can get the podcast after that. Look forward to talking to you then. Bye for now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.